Well, today we're going to be looking at the book of Matthew. We have just finished a sermon series about rest. For a month, we talked about what it is to have rest. But today, we're going to be diving into the book of Matthew. And before we get in there, though, I got a question for you. For you, what is the good life? What is the good life for you? You see it behind me on the slide. The good life may be just sitting out on the beach, a beautiful day, a cold drink, resting. Maybe you've got a book in your hand. Maybe that's your picture of the good life. Or maybe your picture of good life is different. Maybe it's just sitting at home on Sunday after church, watching a good football game. If that's the case, you're probably not a Panthers fan, because I don't think that could be any Panthers' good life right now. Maybe it's something different than that. If you were to ask my wife, she would say the good life for her is gardening, is being out in the garden and just seeing the things grow and tending for her garden. Good life could be a lot of different things, but I want you to think about it, and I want to capture that image. What is the good life for you? And I want you to go beyond the circumstances, the thing that makes it a good life, and I want you to think about what you feel in your heart and your soul when you're experiencing that good life. What is that experience? Because I think what we're going to see today, as we look now at the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, 1 through 11, the Beatitudes, what we're going to see in this text is that God has a way for his followers to experience the good life in Jesus. There is a way to experience the good life. In fact, that's what the Beatitudes tell us. The Beatitudes teach us that the way of Jesus to us leads to the good life. In fact, Matthew 5, 9 different times, he uses the words blessed. Blessed is. Blessed is, blessed is, blessed is. If you were paying attention to Amy as she was reading, you would hear this phrase over and over and over again. Blessed is the person who. Blessed is the person who. And so the question is, what does the word blessed mean? What does the word blessed mean? Well, there's at least 2 different biblical categories for the word blessing. All right, the Beatitudes show us that to be blessed is to, one, is to have a right relationship with God. All right? In the Bible, we learn that all humans were created to be in a relationship with the Lord. And it's impossible to be fully blessed if you aren't connected in a right way to your relationship with the Lord. So part of the word blessed is a relational word. It's a relational meaning. But it's also not just to be right with God, but it also means having a flourishing life, which is something that all people want, right? I mean, even in our country, there's this aspirational value that we haven't really ever lived up to fully, right? But you see this in the founding documents. We're looking for the life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, right? There's this desire to live a happy life, a flourishing life. We want lives filled with joy. Well, the Beatitudes, which, by the way, the reason why we call Matthew chapter 5, 1 through 11, the Beatitudes, is that in Latin, blessed be or blessed is, that is beatitudo. All right, that's the Latin. And so that's the reason why it's just become common parlance. If you've ever, you know, read the book of Matthew, you're probably familiar with that word, the Beatitudes. All right, so what we're going to talk about today is the way of Jesus that leads to a flourishing life. Okay, now I want to be clear. Jesus is not promising you that if you follow his way, your life will be without storms. In fact, Jesus promises you that if you follow him, your life will have storms, right? But here's the key. A flourishing life experiences internal peace even in the midst of external storms. Internal peace even in the midst of external storms, right? And we see that all throughout Scripture. One of the books of the Bible that most talks about joy is the book of Philippians. Philippians was written by a man as he was rotting away in jail, in prison, having no freedom, in physical pain. And yet he wrote about a joy that exists even in the midst of storms. Now, let's be realistic. This is not to say that at every point in your life, no matter how bad life gets around you, that you're going to be this model of perfect peace. Always just fully rejoicing with a happy face. That's not it. Sometimes it's going to feel like that those storms, as the slide shows now, all but crowd out the peace, right? And we see this even in some of our scriptural heroes, right? Think about Jesus, the Son of God, God himself. Yet in the Garden of Gethsemane, right before he's going to be crucified and experience the wrath of God, he is in agony. His soul is in agony. Now, was he not experiencing the peace of God? Well, yes, but it comes and goes, right? Like, what we're not trying to do, what I don't want to do is give you this kind of false salesman pitch. This like, hey, if you follow Jesus, man, everything is going to be smooth sailing for you. Sometimes it feels like the storms all but crowd out our joy. But here's the thing. If you are a follower of Christ, you know that the hope remains, that the peace remains, that the storms will come and go, but what is constant is the goodness of God. It's always there for you. There'll be other times in life when you experience the peace that all but crowns out the storms. There'll be times in life when just the spiritual blessings of God fill you up and there is just blessed peace. Thank you, Jesus. There have been moments in my life when it feels like a lot of things are falling apart, and yet I'll have these moments. I'd love to say I'm this, you know, spiritual hero, right, who's always walking around with maximal peace and maximal joy inside. The reality is that's not true. But there have been times in my life when, despite the world around me seeming to fall apart, God has just given me a blessing of even for a moment, even for 15 minutes, even for 30 minutes, even for an hour, just this respite where I'm communing with him and I'm like, it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. The goal is this. You know, you got these two realities, right? You got the storm and you got the peace, right? Here's the goal. The goal is to know that as a Christian, you can always return home to the peace of God. You can always return home. Yet, yes, there will be times when the cares of this world will fill up your mind and your anxieties just keep bubbling up, right? There will be times. There will be times when life hits you unexpectedly and you're just suffering more than you thought you would at a certain time. There are times when that's going to be happening. But this is the hope for the Christian, is that you can always return home to the peace of God. That's what we're going to look at today. Now, let's dive into Matthew chapter 5. But before we dive into Matthew chapter 5, what I want to do is read a couple of verses before Matthew chapter 5 starts and the end of Matthew chapter 4 so that we can get the context of this passage, all right? The Sermon on the Mount is Matthew 5 through 7. And Jesus is teaching this sermon. It's a very popular sermon. Many of you might have been familiar with this sermon. But it starts out, the context for Jesus' sermon is that he is teaching, he is preaching, he's ministering to the crowds. And that's what we see in Matthew chapter 4. Now, Jesus began to go all over Galilee, teaching in their synagogues, preaching the good news of the kingdom, healing every disease and sickness among the people. And then what happens? Because Jesus' ministry, his teaching is so authoritative, they're like, I've never heard anything like this. And because Jesus' ministry is so powerful and they're seeing miracles happen, news spreads. He becomes a celebrity very early on. News spread about him throughout all Syria. And so they brought to him all who were afflicted, those suffering of various diseases and intense pains, the demon-possessed, the epileptics, and the paralytics. And then it says this, Matthew 4:24, and he healed them. All the people who was brought to him, he healed, and large crowds followed him from Galilee, the Decapolis, Jerusalem, Judea, and beyond the Jordan. Okay, so Jesus is ministering, and lots of crowds are following. Now in one sense, you might think that's a great thing, right? There's all these people who are interested in Jesus. But the problem is, Jesus knows that there's a difference between the crowds who just want to get something for Jesus. You know, I mean, some of the people in the crowd are like, I got nothing to do today. I hear about this miracle worker. Let's go see and be entertained, right? And I'll be honest, that's still how some people relate to Jesus today. It's like, well, hey, I don't want to go to hell, and so Jesus is all right with me, right? And that's kind of where it stands, right? There are these crowds, but not all the crowds were true followers. And so the crowds are actually creating a problem because Jesus actually wants to communicate to his true disciples. Right? So Matthew 5 says this, verse 1. And when he saw the crowds, he went up on the mountain. And after he sat down, his disciples came to him. And then he began to teach them. Okay. In just a second, we're going to get into the actual teaching, the Sermon on the Mount, right? But first, two things that are really important from the initial kind of intro here that we see. First of all, I want you to focus on the word crowds, and then I want you to focus on he went up the mountain, okay? Because both of these are helpful for us as we're getting ready to hear Jesus' most famous sermon to us today, all right? Two key questions I want you to ask. One, given what I've already told you about the crowds, I want to ask you this. Are you a fan or are you a follower of Jesus? Are you a fan or are you a follower? Because here's the interesting part. Jesus is teaching for quite a while here, okay? And as he's up on the mountain, he's sitting down, he's teaching. His immediate audience is the disciples. He's teaching the disciples, the true followers of Jesus. But on the outskirts, the crowds are still there. And we know that because at the very end of the Sermon on the Mount, it says that the crowds were astonished by all that he had been teaching them. So you say, well, who's Jesus teaching? Is he teaching the disciples or is he teaching the crowds? And the answer is yes. He's teaching both of them. All right? But the key difference is how they react. The disciples hear the word of the Lord and they're humbled. And they follow. The crowds are there for Jesus as long as he's giving them what they want. That's a fan. It's a fan. We're called to be followers of Jesus. And so even as we get ourselves ready to hear the teachings of Jesus, I'm just going to go ahead and warn you, over the next couple months, there's going to be some teachings. And the teachings, by the way, it's not from me, right? I'm just the mouthpiece. It's from Jesus. Some of them are going to maybe make you uncomfortable. Some of the things that Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount may be a little offensive to you. It may actually like force you to change some aspect of your life. Question is, are we a fan or a follower? A fan says, oh, Jesus is saying something uncomfortable, I'm out. The follower says, Jesus is saying something that makes me uncomfortable. I need to follow Jesus and change. Right? Are we a fan or a follower? Second thing is this. The fact that Jesus goes up the mountain should put us on notice. Because, y'all, all throughout the Bible, especially in the Old Testament, big things happen on mountains. Big things happen on mountains. I mean, you can go all the way back to the Old Testament, the book of Genesis. When the flood comes, the people in the ark, the ark lands on the mountain, Mount Ararat. And that's where Noah and his family makes a new covenant with the Lord, right? Or, you know, fast forward, you think about Exodus and Moses on Mount Sinai. We already covered this several months ago. God meets with the Israelites on the mountain. It's an important time. Or you think about Elijah doing battle with the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel. Or you think, fast forward to the New Testament, Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration, he goes to the Mount of Olives, and he is transfigured with Peter and John there with him. Big things happen on the mountains. And not only that, but the fact that Jesus, the teacher, is going up to the mountain to teach the law of God. Look, if you are an Israelite right now, you're like, your alarms are going off. Oh, this is important. Because the last time a key leader went up to the mountain to teach God's law, that was Moses on Mount Sinai, teaching the very word of the Lord. Now, interestingly, when Moses goes up there, he has to receive the law first, and then he gives it to the people. And the nation of Israel's changed from that point forward. What's different here is because Jesus is so much better, bigger, more powerful than Moses. He is God himself. When Jesus comes up, he doesn't have to receive the law. He immediately gives the law. And so for us, again, as we're getting ready to hear Jesus speak to us, we need to be on notice. We need to, have you ever been in a movie and you just kind of know something important is getting ready to happen, right? And, you know, movies come, movies go. There's some high points of tension where everyone's dialed in. Other times people are kind of a little distracted. But you kind of sense when something important is getting ready to happen. So you kind of lean in, maybe get the edge of your seats. Or have you ever been to a concert? A lot of time in concerts, they'll play a lot of background music to get people pumped up and hyped up before the show. But once the artist is getting ready to come out there, they lower the lights, they turn the music down, letting everyone know, oh, it's getting ready to happen, right? And so everyone kind of pauses, everyone gets really focused on what's getting ready to happen, right? Or students, all right, kids in class, have you ever been in a class lecture, right? Teachers teaching, and you know, sometimes you're dialed in, sometimes you get distracted. But have you ever heard your teacher say this? Hey, y'all, I want you to know this will be on the test. Now, I'm not the smartest guy, but when the teacher said this is going to be on the test, I'm like, oh, I better get out my note, stop doodling, and I need to start taking notes. This is important. Well, when Jesus goes up on the mountain, sits down, and begins teaching, y'all, we need to be like, oh, this is going to be good. This is going to be important. All right, one last context, and then we'll get into it. I promise you, one last. There's two main points that I want you to get through the sermon. One, we've already talked about, the fact that the way of Jesus leads to a flourishing life, right? The way of Jesus leads to a flourishing life. The second thing is this, is the way of Jesus contrasts with the way of the world. And here's the thing. Look at the next slide here. I just want to say, this slide is intended to convey how some people feel about what's going on right now in the world, right? And by, you know, I know it's got an American flag behind you. It's all over the world, right? But in the United States, there are some people, you may be among them, who feel like, man, things are just getting bad. You know, there's more anger than I've used to experiencing, you know, over the past, you know, couple years. There just feels like everyone's fighting. Government's not working so well. I mean, it's currently shut down. You know, there's just things aren't going that great, right? And there seems to be a way of the world. If you hear people talk, news reporters or politicians talk in the world, a lot of times it's real angry, right? And it feels like just this combative style. And sometimes the words translates to actual violent actions, right? And so the way of the world feels angry. It feels divisive. It feels like hot. It feels like we other people, right? We other others. We say, hey, those people out there, I've heard some folks say those people are animals or those people aren't human. We demonize others. That's the way of the world. The Beatitudes teach us that the way of Jesus is opposed to the way of the world. Y'all, this is so important. So important. I mean, in some ways, if you were to ask me, hey, what do, let's say especially Christians, what do Christians in this time need to hear, need to focus on? I would say, man, it would be great if every professing Christian just spent months meditating on the Sermon on the Mount. Because here's the reality, y'all. You know this. Not everyone who says, hey, I'm a Christian, lives that out. You know that? Not everything done in the name of Christ is truly Christian. You know that. There have been some heinous, some awful acts throughout history done in the name of Jesus. Wars fought unjustly in the name of Jesus, right? Slavery perpetuated in the name of God. Not everything that claims to be Christian truly is. And so what we have to do is be careful. We have to be discerning. And we have to say not what has the name of Christian, but what actually is the way of Christ. What is the way of Jesus? And family, that is what we're going to focus on today. So two key points, and we're going to keep going back to these points all throughout as we kind of dive in. The Beatitudes teach us that the way of Jesus is opposed to the way of the world, and also the Beatitudes teach us that the way of Jesus leads to the good life. All right, here's what I'm going to do. You see this slide behind me? On the one side, you see the way of Jesus, and on the other side, you see a verse. So what I'm going to do is go through the slides, and we're going to just read through Matthew 5, 1 through 11, and we're going to, on the one hand, we're going to start looking at the way of Jesus. So everything that you see on the right side of the screen, that is going to be the way of Jesus. And then we're going to look verse by verse by verse as it kind of teaches us what that way is. And this is the important thing, because there's a lot of material here. And I don't want to get lost in the details of each little verse. So every time I throw a verse up there, we're going to talk a little bit about it, what it means, and how it's opposed to the way of the world, and how it's opposed, and how it leads to the good life. But really, what I want you to do is this. If you come away from the sermon, and you only have one thing, then I'll be happy. If you have a general overall sense of what the way of Jesus looks like, feels like, you can sense it, you've got the flavor of the way of Jesus, then I think the Lord will be blessed and will be encouraged. So as I'm going through these verses, please try to get a sense of what is the way of Jesus? What does it feel like? What does it experience? Because what we need as we go out into the world this week, and as we're interacting with a whole bunch of people who are super restless, who are super discouraged, who are super worried, who are scared, what Jesus calls us to be is to be folks who have experienced the peace of God to the extent that as we walk the way of Jesus, we can minister to others around us simply by living out this way in our Monday through Saturday life. All right, let's look at the first verse. Verse 3. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. For the kingdom of heaven is theirs. Poor in spirit. Now, what does this mean? I think a good picture, Jesus often would encounter beggars, spiritual, or beggars. As he walked along and ministered, he would encounter people who had nothing, and they would cry out to Jesus. Jesus, have mercy on me. Sometimes they were blind. Sometimes they were crippled. Sometimes they had leprosy. Sometimes they were notorious sinners. Over and over and over again, Jesus interacted with folks who were poor, who were outcast, who were exiled, who had nothing. And they would simply have this beggar's mentality. That's what poor in spirit means. God is calling all of us to recognize the fact. Here's the thing. Recognize the fact that you and I, whether you realize it or not, we are spiritually poor. So what does a beggar do? Opens hands to receive. Receive. See, this is the difference between the Pharisees in the Old Testament, or excuse me, in the New Testament, who already thought that they had a lot to give to God. They came pretty proud of all of their works. They felt pretty good about it. They're like, hey, I got a bag full of good works, all right? God owes me something. That's the Pharisee. That's the legalist. The spiritual beggar says, Lord, I have nothing to give to you. Would you be gracious and merciful to me? That's what it means to be poor in spirit. And in some ways, family, That's the picture of Christian life from start to finish. Because the entrance into the Christian life is by saying, I'm a sinner and I need you, Jesus. And to the day you die, no matter how mature you get, in some ways, the more mature you get spiritually, the more you'll recognize how spiritually poor you are. Right? I find this all the time, and it irritates me, but this is the way of God, right? I feel like I'm doing some battle in some area of my life with sin, and I'm wrestling with it, and God finally gives me victory over this, and I'm like, oh, like he's helping me, right? And I'm like, whew, I got that one covered. And then he shows me something else. And I'm like, oh, I didn't even know that was there. I was so focused on this area of my life that I didn't realize I had sin in this area. He's like, oh, yeah, you did. And then it's the same thing, right? Start working on that, and it's time. And, you know, sanctification's messy, but, like, the Lord gives me some victory, and I'm like, oh, man, I'm feeling good. And it's like, all right, David, look over here. I'm like, oh, come on. Spiritually poor. We need the Lord's grace, and that's a posture. All right, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. But also, blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Why are we called to mourn, right? It's not that God's calling all of his children just to go around being sad and depressed all the time, but we're called to mourn because of the reality of the world we live in, right? And the reality of our broken hearts, all right? The brokenness outside the world and the brokenness inside of us, right? Yo, it's easy, right? Think about this is the way of Jesus, you know, being those who mourn. What's the way of the world? The way of the world is to kind of put on blinders to all that stuff. Be like, hey, I'm going to get mine, and good luck to my neighbors. I'm going to get mine, and, you know, I'm just going to not think about the bad stuff going on in the world. I heard one comedian say one time that, you know, he was hanging out with some really ultra-wealthy folks, and he's like, I noticed something about the ultra-wealthy, and this is not a dig on rich people, that's not it, but he's saying one of the things that he noticed is that as he was hanging out with these ultra-wealthy folks is that anytime you tell them anything bad, you know, you say, hey, you know, did you hear about so-and-so had cancer, or did you hear that so-and-so got in trouble with the police, and, you know, his son is in jail, you know, he's like, you know, I'd be talking to these rich folks, and the rich folks say, I wish them well. And then they hit their golf club and they keep going on. That's a picture. That's a picture of the opposite of those who mourn. It's those who are like, hey, yeah, tough luck to them. I got my life here. We are called as Christians to mourn the reality of brokenness in this world. Not mourn with those who have no hope, right? Like, we know that there is hope, but we see the brokenness. We see our neighbors who are in need. And we care, we lament, we rejoice with those who rejoice, and we mourn with those who mourn. We mourn the brokenness in this world. We mourn the evil systems in this world. And this is perhaps for many of us the most uncomfortable, we mourn the sin in our own hearts, right? Yo, it's so easy to get angry with the sin out there. But so often God's like, hey, I want you to redirect that. And how clear are you in your life? It's easy to see the sin out there, but God's calling us to see and to mourn the sin in our own hearts. Blessed are those who are poor in spirit. Blessed are those who mourn. Blessed are those who are humble, for they will inherit the earth. That's verse 5. Blessed are the humble, as some translations say, meek. Now, the most common translation for this one is meek, so I'm going to focus on that for a minute. A lot of times, I don't know if because the words rhyme or what, but a lot of times when we hear meek, we think weak, right? That's not biblically what meek means. When Jesus says, blessed are the meek, the word meek is actually a strong word. It's a word that connotes strength. The meekness you see on the screen behind me is oftentimes is described a battle horse. A battle horse, you see on the screen behind me, the battle horse is a strong horse, and yet a strong horse that is brought into submission. See, a battle horse has phenomenal strength, right? More than any man, phenomenal strength. But the battle horse is taught to respond to the slightest influence by the rider. So meekness is actually strength that is brought under submission. And so, family, that's so helpful for us because as God's children, God has given us tremendous strength. The Holy Spirit is in us. We have gifts. We are image bearers of Christ, all of us. And yet God calls us to use the strength and to bring it under submission to the Lord. That's the way of Jesus. And so you might find yourselves at times tempted to get in there and, you know, people out there are yelling and screaming and angry and, you know, just so upset and they're just kind of giving vent to their emotions. They're on social media and they're kind of going at it on the right or they're going at it on the left. And there's so much anger. You may feel yourself tempted to kind of give in to that and to get in there. We need to submit ourselves not to our natural, sometimes sinful inclinations. We are called to submit ourselves to the Lord. submit ourselves to God. The way of Jesus, verse 6, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Hunger and thirst for righteousness. You know, some commentators have said that this is probably the central phrase, the central kind of piece, central verse in the Beatitudes, because it's kind of going at the core of your heart's desire. You know, what are you longing for? Are you hungry and thirsting for righteousness? And if so, then the other pieces will sort of fall into place. If you're really hungry for God, thirsting for his righteousness, then as a result, you will be poor in spirit. That there will be a mourning with the and lamenting the sins and the brokenness in the world. There will be a humility that comes with you if you hunger and thirst for righteousness. This is an inward drive. Not to say that we're all going to get there, always. None of us should look at someone else and put them on a pedestal saying, hey, they're always righteous. They're always following the way of the Lord. By the way, righteousness has a Godward dynamic and a horizontal dynamic. When the Bible uses righteousness, it's talking about holiness before the Lord, doing the things that God says are for Christians to do and avoiding the things that not. So there's a Godward dimension, and then there's a social dimension as well. It's loving neighbor. It's loving God and loving neighbor. That's what righteousness means. Blessed are those who not only occasionally do this thing, right? That's the difference. You pick out almost anyone in the world, I'm sure there's exceptions, and you could probably point to something that they've done sometime that demonstrates a desire to do the right thing. You know, this is the reality. All of us are created in the image of God, and therefore we have some of God's character in us. The worst of us, that's true for. And so anyone in the world is going to have an occasional kind of, you know, thought to do the right thing. But this is calling us to have an almost obsessive desire, to hunger, to thirst, to think about, to spend time thinking about how can I follow God. Verse 7, blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown merciful. Mercy has the element of compassion for someone who's hurting, and also an aspect of forgiveness, right? Different times the Bible uses different things. Behind me you'll see this picture, that, and there's this parable that Jesus tells of the unmerciful servant. There's this parable that Jesus tells where you've got one servant and a master, and the servant has this pretty big debt, all right? Pretty big debt. Let's say it's, you know, in our time, let's say it's like, you know, $50,000. Now, I don't know about you, I don't have $50,000 in my bank account. That's a debt, right? And $50,000 this servant cannot pay off. And so at the time, the result of this would be if the servant can't pay it off, then there are going to be extra punishments given, sometimes pulling the family into servitude, all right? The servant, he begs the king or the master for forgiveness. Hey, would you please forgive me? Just give me a little more time. And the master, being merciful, says, your debt is forgiven. $50,000 wiped clean. Whew. All right? The servant doesn't stop there. The story doesn't stop there. If it did, that'd be a happy story, but it actually gets kind of bad. Because the same servant who was forgiven that, let's say, $50,000, he goes and someone else owes him $5,000. Now, let's be real, $5,000 is not nothing, right? If you know, if I owe you $5,000, you're gonna feel some kind of way about that if I don't pay it back, right? All right. So, but it's nothing compared to $50,000. So the servant who was already forgiven the $50,000 goes to the servant with $5,000. Same thing happens. The servant begs, please, please forgive me. The servant who was forgiven the debt of $50,000 has no mercy on the servant who owes the $5,000, and so he throws him into prison until he can pay off the debt. First master hears about it and, of course, is enraged. Enraged. And the unmerciful servant is thrown in prison. And the point for us, you and I, is if we have been forgiven much by God, and we have, then how can we not forgive those who sin against us? Family, it doesn't mean it's going to be easy. Jesus didn't say, therefore, it will be easy for you as you show mercy to others. No, oftentimes, showing mercy, it's very painful. but God calls us to look to him and to see the mercy that has flowed out like a flood on us. He just asked us to, you know, have a little, you know, spring flow of water going to others. A tidal wave has come on us. We just need to drip a little mercy on others, right? The way of Jesus is merciful. Finally, or not finally, but close to finally, verse 8, blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Pure in heart, this is an inside out change. God calls us not just as Christians to act right, but to be right in our spirit. To not just put on the fake smile, but to let God do the work in us, changing us from the inside out. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called sons of God. Verse 9. A peacemaker is someone who comes into the room. Have you ever experienced this? There's just tension in the room, right? Some people aren't getting along. It's just not going well. And then there's someone who steps into the room, and this someone's got some gravitas. Maybe it's granddad, right? Or maybe it's grandma. And she comes into the room, and because of who she is or who he is, the room, the atmosphere changes a little bit. There's still some tension, but everyone knows, oh, we got to act right. Grandma's in the room. God calls us to be men and women who have experienced the peace of God so we can share that peace. Blessed are the peacemakers. Family, you want some homework this week? You didn't ask for it, but I'll give you some. In your work week this week, with your friends, with your family, ask Jesus to help you be a peacemaker. Yo, that's applicable, that's relevant. In every circumstance, help me to follow the way of Jesus by being a peacemaker. When others are anxious, let me lead with calm. When others are angry, let me lead with love. Blessed are the peacemakers. And finally, verses 10 through 12, I'm not going to read it all, but I'll read the first verse. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for the kingdom of heaven is theirs. Blessed are the persecuted, even when folks are coming at you for doing the right thing. You are blessed. Because when others mean injury for you and others mean harm, God means good. I know, and I've experienced this in my life, there have been times when I have suffered and I didn't do anything wrong. Now, don't get me wrong, I've suffered for doing wrong before, okay? I'm not trying to put myself on a pedestal. I've suffered for doing wrong, but there are times when I've suffered and I didn't do anything wrong. But someone else came at me and I suffered for it. And in the moment, all I could feel is like the injury. All I could feel is the hurt. But God had a plan. And through this plan, I can look back and say, like Joseph did, what they meant for evil, God meant for good. And God brought me to a better place than I was because of the other person's injury. Blessed are the persecuted. You look at that list for a second. The way of Jesus. Family, this is the way that we're called to live. This is who we're called to be. And by the way, let me remind you again of the gospel of Jesus Christ, which means this is not it. All right, I'm going to tell you the anti-gospel, and then I'm going to tell you the real gospel. Here's the anti-gospel. Do all of these things. That's your checklist. Do all of these things. Try hard enough, and then God will love you. That's the anti-gospel. What's the gospel? God already loved you and forgave you in Jesus Christ. He's already brought the salvation to you. He's already given you the forgiveness. He's already given you the love. He's already brought you into his family. He's done all the things. And because he has, you and I have it's a privilege and it's a responsibility to live out our salvation. Family, the world needs us to follow the way of Jesus. Remember one of our main points, the Beatitudes teach us that the way of Jesus is opposed to the way of the world. Family, the world is dying for Christians to be Christ-like. And I know, probably like me, you've seen examples of Christians in this present moment being very unchristlike. And we can get so bogged down with that that we forget that every moment of our lives is an opportunity to show our friends and our neighbors by our life the way of Jesus. Don't get so frustrated by folks out there who are not following the way of Jesus that you don't see the opportunity right in front of you. There's freedom in that. Today, tomorrow, follow the way of Jesus. And then finally, remember, Beatitudes teach the way of Jesus leads to the good life. Not the perfect life, not the painless life. But the more that you open your hands up to God and trust him, the more that you enable him to pour out his blessings and pour out the peace that surpasses understanding that can guard your heart even when things are falling apart. Let's pray.